Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. This episode is just going to be me. Well, in a little bit, you're going to hear an amazing person. You're going to hear my interview with Rebecca Traister. If you're listening to Hellbent and you've been listening for a while, you probably already know who Rebecca Traister is. She is an amazing writer and feminist scholar, and she writes on women in politics. And this interview is about her new book, Good and Mad. And it was a really, really great interview. I'm so happy I got to interview her because I got to talk to her about why she decided to write about women's rage. And if you haven't read the book yet, I suggest everybody go and pick it up because it's so cathartic to read. It makes you angry. And I think the book is supposed to make you angry. It's supposed to make you furious, not just at what happened in 2016. It's also supposed to make you angry about the whole history of women's movements, the whole history of women's role in politics. But it's also supposed to make you hopeful. And it's really interesting that she's able to, you know, create this feeling of rage and hope when you're reading this book. Because not only are you angry at men, obviously, because men are trash, but you're also angry on behalf of these amazing women throughout history. She talks about amazing women who led such great movements. She talks about contemporary women in politics, like Elizabeth Warren, Barbara Lee, Hillary Clinton. She talks about Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris. She talks about so many women in politics and how they've had to at times temper their rage, at how they've had to harness their rage. And she really does a good job of breaking down what women's anger looks like and how women's anger can drive movements, can drive some of the most important reform movements in our history, right? And she also makes it really clear how women's anger doesn't just drive these movements, but it can be used as a way to relate to other women. And I think that's the best thing about this book, is that it's not really about, hey, if you're more angry, we'll win. It's more about, this is what it looks like when women are angry. This is what it can look like when we listen to that anger. This is what it can look like when we accept that anger as something that's fruitful, not something that hurts us. And I think that's what's so amazing about this book. And that's what I hope you get from the interview, is that Rebecca Traister is somebody who understands that women's anger has been ignored for too long. And it's not just about shedding light on it. It's about understanding what it can do if we actually tune our ears to hear it properly. And that's what I gained from this book, right? And I didn't get to talk about everything I wanted with Rebecca Traister, but I did get to talk about some amazing topics. And the one thing we had to leave out was she said in another interview how she likes to yell at Joe Biden. And if you're listening to this podcast, you too like to yell at Joe Biden. And I think one thing that I learned from reading her book is that it's good to be angry at people like Joe Biden. It's good to think about the Anita Hill hearings and think about how much damage that did to the women's movement, to feminism, and think about how if we were to think about people like Joe Biden or in general white men running the world again as they are right now, think about what we should demand from them. What kind of concessions, what kind of acceptance, right? And the first thing that I'd want from Joe Biden is a fucking apology to Anita Hill. I'd also want him and other white men to read this book and to think about how they may have asked women to be less angry in the past and how they can't do that anymore. And they can't do that anymore because that's not what's going to get us out of this fucking mess, right? If you're listening to this, it's a few days before the midterms. And what's getting us out of this mess, what's really going to make sure that we win the House or take back the Senate, is the thousands upon thousands of women across the country over the past 2 years who are furious and who haven't said, oh, I'm going to stop being angry, calm down, and just channel that into activism. They're like, no, I'm just going to continue to be fucking angry all the fucking time. And that's what is getting us out of this mess. I think one thing that I really enjoyed about the interview is I got to learn about Rebecca Traister's opinion on coalitions and why she has hope for the future. And one of the reasons I really agree with her is even though I did this interview a while ago, I did it like a few days ago, just today, if you were watching on Thursday, Oprah goddamn Winfrey was stumping for Stacey Abrams in Georgia, right? Oprah Winfrey was canvassing for Stacey Abrams. You know, two amazing women were telling the people of Georgia what it means, what it would mean to have the first Black women governor in the United States history. And it really made me think about what I talked with Traister about when it comes to coalitions and why she feels like there is hope. Because one shift that I have seen from 2016 to 2018 is that the more women are listening to each other and more women are trying to understand why they are angry, not just why they're angry themselves, but why other women are angry. And I hope this interview is useful to you. It was amazing to do. I'm so thankful that Rebecca said yes to the interview. And I'm so, so thankful that she wrote this book, because without even knowing it, I've been wanting this book for a long time. And when I got my hands on it, I think I read it twice in a matter of like 24 hours. I didn't even need to read it twice, but it was that good. So without further ado, here's Rebecca Traister. Well, Rebecca Traister is a writer for New York Magazine. If there's anything going on with women in politics in the United States, she's written something about it. And chances are, if you're listening to this, you've probably read it already. She's also the author of All the Single Ladies and Big Girls Don't Cry. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And God, I love your book so much. I read it twice.
Oh, thank you. Oh my God, yeah. Already? Thank you so much.
I really love the book. And so basically, I'm a historian in training as well. And so when I read history books, I like to figure out how someone is analyzing a change over time and why they choose the way to do so. I'd like to begin with, you know, why you wrote this book. Specifically, why do you choose rage as a category of analysis to understand the power of women? You know, what did an emotions history do for you that a history of women's protest or women's resistance or activists doesn't achieve?
Well, I mean, I think that there's tremendous value in the history of protest activism or kind of action, right? In some ways, my previous book, which is about unmarried women, women living, it's contemporary, but also looks at some of the history of unmarried women and their role within progressive movements. I mean, that's somewhat closer to this alternative view of like looking at a pattern of behavior rather than through an emotional lens. But what drew me to rage in this moment and in this period of American history is that I felt like the power and the consequence of women's rage in a political context was not being granted authority or acknowledgement even. And I felt that in a contemporary sense, and I felt it from an emotional lived sense, though this book is obviously not about me, right? That I know that one of the emotions that is most discounted and discouraged in women is rage. And yet I felt I'm not a historian by trade. I borrow from scholarship of real historians, right? But having known enough about the history of protest, of mass movements, of the progress that's been made in this country to address inequality, I knew in some way that rage was a crucial ingredient. And yet rage was the thing that in the wake of the election, of the 2016 election, in some cases it was those who were maddest about inequality going in who were sort of blamed for having shown their anger. I'd looked at how, you know, rage had been celebrated and acknowledged as a crucial form of expression for some of the male candidates in the race, and yet Hillary Clinton had been chided for yelling. I just had been noticing all this stuff about rage, and I'd also noticed in my own thinking that I kept thinking to myself, oh, I can't think clearly because I'm angry. And there was sort of a moment where I thought, wait, actually, I think my anger is perfectly clarifying. Why am I conditioned to think that it is an inhibitor of thought? Rather than a perfectly valid and clarifying frame of reference. And as soon as I thought that about the contemporary moment, I was like, and also another thing, why haven't we been trained to understand rage as a crucial and catalytic component of social change, because it has been. But of course, when we're talking about the people who've done social change, we're often talking about people who begin from a disempowered position, right? People who are not white men. And in those populations, rage is not considered valid, and it's not valued, and it's not celebrated. And in fact, we take pains not to look at it or acknowledge the role that it's playing. So that was sort of that was how I got to rage as the frame.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I got from reading the book, is that you realize that at some point, you know, we realize that, you know, you said this amazing line in the book, and I think you phrased it better on another podcast I listened to, that, like, you know, white male rage is diagnostic, but female rage is not diagnostic of anything. And so I guess my question is, why do you think women's anger in the present and in the past has been viewed as threatening, like threatening to the patriarchy? Like, why is it so threatening?
Well, because if women's anger is aimed at inequality, and that inequality is part of what a power system is constructed on, which it's true. I mean, this is the history of this country. We don't like to look at it this way. But this country's economy, its government, its systems was built on codified systems of inequality, enslavement, the lack of enfranchisement for women, the labor done by enslaved people and by women within homes, unpaid labor that enabled the public and economic and political participation of white men who built the systems, built the laws, built the courts, built the government, built the institutions, the economy, around their own power, right? And so the whole nation is constructed on these forms of inequality, and the powerful are dependent on the persistence of those forms of inequality. The rage of women, people of color, those who have been systematically kept from power, challenges that power system. So it is a threat. And we know that the power of political rage and inequality is terrifically big, because that's the founding story. And we know that when white men, the colonists in this country, were angry at being taxed and policed without government representation, their explosive rage was disruptive enough to create a war, a revolution, and the building blocks of a new nation, in which they promptly reinscribed all kinds of forms of inequality. But so in our DNA is the knowledge that the uprising of those who have been taxed and policed without adequate representation, those who have been left without liberties, those whose freedoms have been circumscribed by a powerful ruling power, rage at those circumstances carries with it the threat of insurrection and of revolution. That's our founding narrative. And so when rage comes from those on the margins, who have been kept at the margins, it is viewed as a threat because it is a threat.
Yeah, that's so true, and it's such a good way of putting it. Another thing you do a good job in the book of doing is talking about white women's anger as opposed to black women's anger and the anger of women of color in general. I guess my question is, why do you think it's so hard to recognize black women's anger as legitimate, usually more so than white women's anger? You know, why do you think coalitions between women, different classes and races is so difficult? Do you see hope for the future in an intersectional coalition?
Well, the reason that black women's anger is even further marginalized and viewed as more threatening is for exactly the same reason I just described about the power. Because within progressive coalitions, we don't have just one form of inequality in this country. We have so many overlapping and interlocking forms of inequality. And so even within mass, and this is not unique to the women's movement, this is within a civil rights movement, a gay rights movement, the new left of the 20th century, the contemporary left, you have all kinds of biases and hierarchies that exist even within progressive coalitions that are officially designed to challenge power hierarchies. So you have racism and sexism and homophobia and classism and transphobia existing within groups of allies whose official aim is to make the world a more equal place. And within those groups, there is just as much defensiveness and perceived threat when some members, usually those who have less power, challenge other members about their own forms of discrimination or bias. And that is something that has plagued, again, all kinds of progressive movements. But the women's movement in every iteration has been confronted by the tolls of its internal racism and the role that white supremacy plays within a coalition of women. And it is our project. I have to have hope on this front. You know, I understand and respect the people who actually don't have hope, who say, look, we've been at this for, you know, more than two centuries. You know, white women who are offered white supremacy in exchange for their support of a white patriarchy and a fundamentally conservative set of ideas and policies that protect power as it has existed historically in this country and don't actually fundamentally aim to disrupt it. Why should we spend energy counting on those white women to somehow do better when several centuries have shown us that they don't, right? I understand that argument. Perhaps it's because I myself am a white woman and it is my responsibility to, in part, to address my own demographic shortcomings. I feel that to not have hope or to not do work to make this better would be tantamount to surrender to the inequalities. And so it is in part because I feel that hope on this front is a tactical necessity that, yes, I do believe we're capable of being better. I have seen us be better, which is not to say fixed, but I have seen a project of civic engagement and education over the past couple of years amongst some of the white women who are newly politicized that I don't know that I would have seen. In fact, I feel quite certain I wouldn't have seen things 5 years ago or 10 years ago that I have seen over the past couple of years. The white women who showed up in such great numbers during the Women's March Convention in 2017 or 2018 rather, that they had to in a seminar about white supremacy within a women's movement and how to be better allies as white women. There were so many white women who showed up that they had to hold the session again the next day and find a bigger space for 500 people. That this summer when Nancy Pelosi called out Maxine Waters, after Maxine Waters had encouraged peaceful gathering and civil disobedience in response to the horrific child separation policy implemented by the Trump administration. And Maxine Waters had done a righteous and terrific thing in encouraging that civil disobedience and reading the mood of the nation and of the insurrectionists. And she was chided by Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. I saw a letter written by white feminists expressly calling out Nancy Pelosi for her white supremacy. And it was signed by 6,000 white women within a couple of weeks. I don't think I would have seen that letter or that kind of response to it just a few years ago. So I have to have hope that there is a possibility for us to engage and build a better version of a coalition than we have built in past iterations. I have to believe that.
Yeah. I mean, I really have hope of that too, because I saw that same kind of discussion after Nancy Pelosi made that mistake. And it was very frustrating and personal for me, because I look up to Nancy Pelosi, and seeing her put down and respond to another woman's rage like that, another woman's righteous rage like that, was very frustrating to me. You know, so with that said, I'd like to talk about audience. You know, what do you want the different people who read your book to glean from the book, right? Is there a specific message to white women who are reading this? Is there a specific message to men who are reading this book, at least for you?
Well, I think that the message to white women is pretty much about education and listening. I think that one of the, and that's actually the message to men too. So within every coalition, I think this is, you know, a lot of people have interpreted the idea of this book as being about telling women to express their rage differently, you know, yell louder, rage on. It's not about that. It is, I mean, for those who want to, you know, it's about how, not just how your own rage is received, but how you receive the rage of others. And it's about retuning our ears, all of our ears, okay? You know, and this is a multiracial, multigendered call for all of us to look at the patterns around us about how the rage of women, the rage of people who have been offered less power historically and in a contemporary political sense, how their rage is discounted, vilified, turned into the aggressive force, even if it is rage at the abuse, at aggressive power abuse. The way that we cast the protesters of Brett Kavanaugh as the aggressive mob and not Brett Kavanaugh, who is credibly alleged to have been, to have physically assaulted a woman as the aggressor. How minority right wing that pushes through his nomination, you know, contra credible testimony as to his, unfitness for the bench, lack of fitness for the bench, that they're not the mob. It's those whose only power is to raise their voice in protest and dissent, that they are the angry mob, that they are the aggressive force. There's a lot about that, tuning our ears and eyes to see how the anger of the most marginalized is often depicted as the most disruptive and the most aggressive. It is about tuning our training our eyes to look at our own history and see where there has been anger that has been uncelebrated, unacknowledged, and yet has been catalytic to the movements that have transformed the country. Training us to see not just the women and the people of color at the start of movements from which they have often been erased in the popular retelling, but even once we find them, to understand that in part anger, this thing that we're told is an ugly or disqualifying or hysterical or marginalizing force, was actually the righteous spark that drove them into the kind of activism and engagement that led them to create and lead these movements for change that have made our country something closer and closer, not anywhere near, but closer to more equal. And so it is about training ourselves to listen differently to anger, the anger of the underrepresented, the anger of those who have been subjugated and offered less. And to listen to their anger, be curious for it, and then hear when they tell you, to hear it as you said before, treat it as diagnostic in the way, just think of how we treat the anger of white men. And it's right. I don't want to take away from that. When we hear that white men in the Rust Belt are angry because they have been experienced job loss and the ravages of opioid addiction, economic inequality, technological changes that have, left entire industries in tatters, and inaccessibility of healthcare. That is correct. That anger is pointing us toward things in our system that are broken and need to be fixed. That is right. But the point is, we don't hear other people's anger and understand it as that same kind of instructive force that points us toward where things are broken and where we have the power, or should have the power, as a nation with what should be a functional government, to address the things that are broken and that need to be fixed. And so we should hear the anger of women screaming in a Senate Judiciary room about how, if healthcare is repealed or reproductive autonomy is compromised, that they will die. Instead, it's written off by Ben Sasse's hysteria. We should understand women telling us that Black Lives Matter, that their anger is pointing us toward a system that is badly broken and abusive and is violent and does harm. And we should, not just those of us who agree with the protest, but we should be pressuring the media to take that anger as instructive and diagnostic in the same way. But we don't. Those are people who get written off as, disruptive, called terrorists and hate groups. Meghan McCain called Black Lives Matter a hate group. So this is really a call to people to listen to anger differently. And that is especially true for people who have power within progressive coalitions to which they might be sympathetic or in which they might be engaged. So that's white women, that's men. And the message is, listen to the anger of the people with whom you want to be aligned. Look to those people who have less power than you for leadership and instruction and education. Look to them, with curiosity about what is driving them and what's frustrating them.
Yeah. There's this great line in Obama's first inaugural where he says, we should choose our better history. We should carry forward this, precious gift that all of us are equal and we all deserve mm-hmm. this chance to pursue every bit of happiness we deserve. I'm paraphrasing. And I really like that because it fits with your idea of we've spent 8 years trying to tune our ears, but while we were tuning our ears, there was a huge racist backlash building against Obama. There's a huge backlash against women, building against Hillary Clinton. That's been building since the 90s, let's be honest. And so speaking of choosing yes. our better history, an obvious question for me is about Hillary Clinton. If you could choose the legacy or the history of Hillary Clinton, what would it be? How do we understand her anger? Which I know wasn't visible or appealing to many people in 2016, but it was to me. How do you understand and talk about Hillary Clinton's career? And how should we be relating to her and this calamity without people continuing to see us as angry women that are bitter or stuck in the past? And how do we not care about them seeing us as angry and bitter?
Uh-huh. Well, you're asking huge questions. I mean, I don't think we're going to be able to see the story of Hillary Clinton clearly for decades. I think you know, people are still so invested in her. The political situation that we're living in is still so tied to her and in the eyes of those who supported and were angry on her behalf. You know, you can read the current political moment as being, you know, the signal of an injustice made clear and misogyny made clear and racism made clear in ways that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are somehow emblematic of, and that it was the campaign of Hillary Clinton that activated her loss, that activated so many formerly apathetic or somnambulant progressives. Through another lens, the lens that is very invested in a story in criticism of Hillary Clinton, she led us to this. It was, in fact, the enthusiasm for her that got us into this mess, and the pulls of that in this period of calamity, when everyone is scared and very much doesn't necessarily want to reckon with the roles that they themselves and their political leanings played in this. I don't think we can even begin to get clear about, you know, looking at, it's always been hard. I've been writing about Hillary Clinton for many, many years, and it is always hard to write about her with clarity because she has been emblematic of and also buffeted by so many of the forces, so many of the kinds of hierarchies that are at the heart of what's happening right now. It's going to be a long time before we can really wrap our heads around her story with any clarity. That said, I think that as part of the effort to tune our ears, you know, you asked how can we stop caring about the people who are still mad at us about Hillary Clinton, or who are still mad at Hillary Clinton, or who still blame. I mean, gosh, that's a good question, and I don't know.
Because I deal with it a lot. It's like, depending on where you are in the country, I'm in Berkeley, right? I'm in Berkeley. Or even if you're, like, not in Berkeley, if you're somewhere else in, like, America, I feel like everyday people who supported Hillary Clinton, they're the people who are not talked about in the media at all. Like, anytime I see a New York Times op-ed, it's about the Rust Belt. And again, it's okay. Or it's about a Trump voter who's still voting for Trump. Or it's about, you know, somebody else. And there's so few people, journalists or not journalists or whatever, who are being like, oh, wait, there weren't 65 million people who voted for Hillary Clinton. Like, what happened to those people? Oh, I guess they just voted out of convenience.
I think to some extent we have to see what is going to happen again. I don't think those people ultimately – I mean, if I – you know – I don't, when we get a longer view, because we may come back and reconsider those people. In part of what I see is that some of those 65 million people who voted for her are driving the activist resistance in this moment in ways for which they don't get credit. And okay, there are a lot of, I write a lot about my frustrations with the way that the mainstream media and the mainstream political analysis doesn't seem to see so many of the people, many of them women, who are driving the protest movements, the striking, running for office, you know, volunteering for the campaigns, doing the grassroots organizing, building an infrastructure outside the Democratic Party, doing all of this stuff that has really been remarkable over the past couple of years. A hell of a lot of those people are, you know, part of those 65 million. And we don't know what the impact of this new sort of wave or generation of activism is going to be, and we may not know the impact of that for a long time, right? The answer is not necessarily going to come on November 6th, the midterms, or, you know, in November of 2020. These are long-term investments in activism and participation.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that we may not have a clear view of this, but believe me, there are lots of us who are paying attention to who's participating in this.
Yeah.
And I think that we may have a clearer view both of Hillary Clinton's role and of the role of those who supported her, you know, when we get further away from, you know, the scene of the 2016 election.
Yeah, that's fair. When we can finally...
Whatever the future is going to hold.
When we can finally talk about it without somebody saying, no, the DNC primary is rigged, I think that's when we can start analyzing.
Right.
I guess...
Mostly, though, we gotta look forward.
Hi, all. It's me, Devin. I just wanted to add a little coda to this episode because this interview was so wonderful and so necessary and a balm for my soul. Unfortunately, I got caught off a little bit at the end there, but I just wanted to say thank you to Rebecca Tracer and to Varsha and to all of you for listening and being here and sharing your anger with us every week on this show. So Varsha and I will be back on Wednesday. We are not doing a show on Monday. We are going to do a post-election show on Wednesday. So stay tuned for that. Have a wonderful weekend. Raise some hell and vote. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, DickwadsBegone, at facebook.com/groups/DickwadsBegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere. Thank you.